Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Burning down the house here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Your weekly fix of everything and anything related to design, architecture, and the creative arts. This week I want to talk about more about good green topics with Robert Noble, who's an architect and apparently an industrialist, and also with Morgan Noble, who does marketing for Robert's business. Hello, are you there?
We're both here.
Yes.
Excellent, excellent. These are the topics I'd like to talk about today. I'd like to talk a little bit about, because I think my architect listeners would be interested in your background, Mr. Noble. Next up, I'd like to understand a little bit about how you went from being an architect to being an entrepreneur slash industrialist, or to put it in colorful terms, how you went from being Howard Roark to Hank Reardon, and then those of you who are lay people who listen, you need to read your Ayn Rand, very important in the world of architecture. And then I want to talk about some of your products, your solar ventures, and then E-Core, and then we can get expansive about other things that you see that are developing and or interest you, or wherever our conversation might meander. Keep in mind, this is not an interview. This is just a conversation. Jack, we have our first little break.
The program has been brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery. Cain Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cain5.com.
Burning down the house. We're talking about new tech with Robert Noble and Morgan Noble. This is Burning Down the House, and Mr. Noble, let's talk about a little bit about your background as an architect, your Howard Roark period of life.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the Howard Roark comparison.
I apologize because I'm supposing you have never dynamited your own buildings.
Well, I tell you, I've considered it on many occasions, as most architects have. But I love the parallel. In fact, when I was at Harvard Graduate School of Design, we had a little showing of Ayn Rand's, you know, the Fountainhead, the movie, and we all got a big kick out of it. But
yeah, because anyway, it's so wrong. But okay,
it's so wrong. But it,
well, in one scene, Gary Cooper's drawing using his triangular scale, and you never draw with the scale. But okay,
yeah, exactly. Well, let me give you a bit of a kind of an overview. I studied architecture at Berkeley and at Harvard, and also went to Cambridge University. And so, as I like to say, I had enough education for my entire family combined. But I started off in architecture, and on the design side, I was fortunate to be able to design buildings at the firms that I worked in California, and then back in New York City, and worked for Beyer Blunder Bell for a couple years when I got back there. And but events took over, and I ended up designing manufactured building systems for a company, a manufacturing company in Texas, and invented and then patented these building systems that the panels were made from compressed wheat straw, which was a sustainable material. Before I knew it, I was thrown into the green design movement. People showed up from all over the world to meet with us, and we got a lot of press exposure. So that's how I got launched into, you know, green products and materials, and that moved on to founding a company called GridCore, GridCore Systems International. And we had a factory in Long Beach that produced structural panels made from recycled cardboard and paper and some other things.
And about when was that, GridCore?
That was during the 90s. That was between 92 and 99. And had to move on from that for a number of reasons. And then launched a few companies, actually a .com and a small housing.
Well, wait. You're getting way ahead of yourself. Slow down.
Well,
92, 94. When did you depart from GSD?
Well, I left in 79. So
we got a period of some years there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, I'm trying to compress it.
There's no reason to compress. We've got another 45 minutes before we run out of oxygen supply here. We're good. We've also been joined by Jake Allspector, Architect of New York. Hello.
Hi. How are you, Robert?
Fine. How are you, Jake?
I'm great. Thank you. Sorry to be late. We're having infrastructure or reconstruction in New York, and the L train was completely shut down for the weekend.
Some of us do research in advance to find that out, but that's okay. I'm so glad that you're here. Jake.
It's a train I never travel except when I come here.
Well, thank you. Jake went to our common alma mater, Cooper Union, and then I went on because there were no jobs and got a MArch too at your alma mater, Robert. Or is it
right.
Bob? Which do you prefer?
Bob's fine.
Bob, I also have a degree from GSD.
Yes, I saw that.
I was building a building across the street from GSD while you guys were going to school there. I just finished.
What were you working on?
Kennedy Hall, the dorm right across from the Science Center.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's because you're so old, man.
But I think it was done by 74 or 5. When you guys were still in diapers.
I remember the building, and I remember Charles Guafmi, too. Met him there.
Charlie. Remember Charlie?
I do remember Charlie.
Jake worked with Charlie for...
People won't let me forget him.
A long time. But that's okay.
Which is the way he wanted it.
Well, it worked. Yes.
But going back to the late 70s and early 80s, we didn't think about energy all that much, right?
We did at Ehrenkranz. We did.
Well, Ehrenkranz.
Did you know Ezra Ehrenkranz, Robert? Or Bob?
Well, I knew the firm, and I knew you thought about energy. Absolutely.
Well, we did a whole thing for the Department of Defense, but
yeah.
And
you know, it's a Curtis. It's an interesting question. I've reflected for myself on you know, my evolution. At Berkeley, the first course I took as an undergraduate was environmental control systems, and I absolutely loved it. Of course, then 3.5 years at Harvard, there was nothing addressing energy or the environment for that period of time. I remember a lot about Corbusier and a variety of other things, but really that the passion that I developed for everything environmental and energy and green started at Berkeley in 73.
Yeah. Well, in 73, the only environmental control system that I was aware of was a thermostat.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, you might have a barometer hanging on the wall that would tell you whether the weather was going to change.
Well, that's not true. No, there's always been solar alternative energy, whatever you want to call it.
Well, if you want to get movement. Back to the Stewart Brand era with the whole world
catalog. Definitely, and I picked, on that. I picked up on that when I did my thesis was a self-sufficient farm. And all the formalists, the Cooper Union at the time, wouldn't talk to me, basically.
I can
Except
well
for Rick Scafidio, he's the only, if you could call him a formalist, who would talk to me.
I don't think of Rick as a formalist so much as just a character who's loose on the landscape.
But anyway, you know, there were a whole bunch of architects who were, as you probably know from the history of it, who were practicing that, looking at that. People were manufacturing them in their backyards, and it was like the PVB industry, but they didn't have PVVs. Those were, like, really out of sight. There was no
PVV?
PBV.
Poly...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Polybutyl vinyl. You mean like solar collectors?
Yeah.
Okay. You mean, you put up some corrugated siding on the roof, you run water over it, you cover it over like a little greenhouse.
Well, some are very sophisticated, they're still those are Owens Corning guys, right? But I understand you make some...
We're going to get to that next. Okay. I would like to set the stage for how...
Are you trying to structure this?
Is the attempt.
Okay. All right. We'll give it to you.
Well, you know, I like...
See, Jake, Curtis, Jake and I are just so biting at the bit to kind of... we're going to pass control back to you.
It's okay. I like that... that there might be narrative.
But you never knew this about me, right?
I did not.
Yeah, see.
I have to admit,
you
I
gotta
did.
Look at the resume, man.
You know, when you gotta read the CVs of your friends, it's kind of... It could
I'm
be bad.
I'm a complicated guy.
I know you're a complicated guy. I mean, you're practically as complicated as David Byrne.
Anyway, we built a bunch of these houses for the DOD. NASA was supposed to produce a black box to take data and actually learn from something, which is what this whole program, we did about 50 of them on military bases, various climates, various collector types, various storage types, state of the art at the time, plus some very wacko stuff too, thrown in. And
I'm not going to ask about the wacko.
Well, no,
I don't want this to go totally off the rails.
Well, there were people doing strange things with, big reflectors and things, but...
Oh, well, that'll come around.
No, but there were always people doing this, and I took a look at your websites, because I prodded Curtis, and I just love your product and all that, but I know we'll come to it
later.
We'll
get to that. No, I think the power of narrative requires a little background, and this didn't just spring up from nowhere, right?
Well...
Bob? Jake?
Right.
I mean, this is a long time in coming.
Yeah, I love that Jake's. I love that Jake's talking about it. The thesis that he did, that he, you know, he was had you know some. It was really disruptive, and that's the fondest memory that you have related to this subject. It's what you carved out then. You know, you were a wacko, I guess.
A little bit.
We're all a little.
Cooper encouraged wackiness. It's the wackier, the better. It was like who could outwack each other.
Yeah, it was that kind of place. We're trying to hold on to that
Still
sort
is.
Of wackiness.
Yeah, you know? We are.
We need to talk about that offline.
Oh, boy, I don't have time for that. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, I know. Back to topic.
You should have a whole program on that. You probably did.
I did. Yeah. 1.5 programs on...
Anyway. Financial problems. What else is new, Robert, right?
Yeah, our Cooper Union is considering charging tuition, and for the last 100 years it has been a tuition, a full scholarship school, and the sieve through which you are passed to be accepted had didn't have to pay tuition. On the minus side, or you might say the plus side, the programs were very rigorous, and you were expected to exceed in terms of, you know, as you say, Jake, wackiness. And a lot of us alumni, and I'm part of the angry alumni.
Well, there were conservative members of the faculty too then.
Cohort.
Anyway.
Yeah, well.
I don't know if that's still true.
I are working towards preserving that somehow.
That'll get me
but
in trouble
let's get
with
back
my
to
faculty friends.
Early environmentalism.
Well, it goes way back before. I mean, Corbeau was totally focused on that, and he learned from his mistakes, just like all the other architects.
And none of his southern Mediterranean houses has air conditioning.
Well, you don't need
it in that climate.
Right, right. You just need mass.
Gets pretty hot down there.
At least if it doesn't change.
His little cabana there.
Cap Martin.
Yes, that has no air conditioning.
No, I wouldn't think so.
No, it works perfectly well.
Yeah, you don't need it in a marine environment with a continuous breeze and reasonable humidity conditions, you know.
Which sounds like San Diego, Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, you solar guys have it, you know, I mean, you have it well, because you're in the right place.
Yeah, it's great here for a load of reasons. But I tell you something that happened to me recently, you know, related to this subject. I visited Taliesin in just, you know, outside of Phoenix in Scottsdale. And, you know, through my studies at Berkeley and Harvard and Cambridge, my focus was more around, you know, Corbusier and Mies and Aalto and Lucan and others.
The modern canon.
Yeah, and I didn't really appreciate Frank Lloyd Wright to the extent that that I do now. Visit to Taliesin and just walking through and reading more about his works. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright was an environmental architect from the very beginning.
Totally right.
In every way, not just in how his buildings fit within the environment, took advantage of all of the passive opportunities, but in terms of system building, which he started so early, and energy efficient local materials and all of that, in ways that are just now being, you know, understood. And it just changed my perception about what a leader he was.
Yeah, and he learned from the Viollet-le-Duc, and then it goes back before that to a few other people.
Stealing my thunder
way back
again.
To Vitruvius. It's my thunder, man. I brought that to this show.
No, I mentioned it, and you ran with it. All right.
I teach it, man.
Speaking of Taliesin, I wonder whether there were some new novice pouring water over the canvas over the drafting room in order to get evaporative cooling. You know, you see pictures where the master is in his cuffs and his bow tie, and I mean, it's Arizona, unless it was February.
It's would have been dry there, though.
It would have been freaking hot.
And if you're in the shade there and it's dry and it's
yeah, but
breezy.
The drafting room has got that canvas roof,
sure.
And so somebody had to be delegated to be. Splashing water on the cabinets.
I've been out there,
and
I must say, I've been out there once or twice, and I haven't been there. And I kicked myself because it's always been on hectic business. And the closest thing I got to was the Biltmore, you know, the Arizona Biltmore.
Yeah.
Which
I highly recommend it. I've been to Scottsdale.
Oh, absolutely.
Many times. I finally went, and I'm going back.
Yeah, no, it's real shame on me that I haven't been.
Well, I've been to Taliesin in July, and the drafting room. Unaccountably was not available to be visited. Everything else was air conditioned.
That happened to me when I visited Taliesin East in the early 70s. It was
well, maybe it burned down again. Anyway, Bob.
Yes.
Back to the structure.
Back to the program?
Yeah, back to structure here.
Oh shit, man. Okay.
This is architecture after all. We need structure. All right.
Next I'd like to talk about how your practice changed and how you moved into entrepreneurship. Jack, could we have 3 minutes of David Bowie? No. The next one. Thank you.
My fault.
Waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million days. dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
You wanna be a richer man.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
There's gonna have to be a different man. Time may change me. Ripples change the size, but never leave the stream of warm permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on as they try to change their worlds are immune to your consultation. They're quite aware of what they're going through.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't tell them to blow up on out of it.
Changes.
Burning down the house, I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Speaking about new technology, changes in our environment with Robert Noble. Possibly with Morgan Noble, his daughter. Are you still there?
Morgan is going to be back in the room in a...
Oh, I guess we lost her. And Jake Allspector, two out of three of us are architects, and we're talking about how the world has changed. And I'm interested in hearing a little bit more at this point, finally. I'm trying to build a narrative here, Bob. You know, it's
okay,
like...
I'll try to help.
Well, without a background... to me, it was miraculous when Morgan came to the place where I work, Cook Plus Fox, and talked about some of your products. And it was like, you know, you have to understand this is internet radio, so we're not subject to FCC rules. It's like, holy shit, how'd this guy do this? How do you go from being Howard Rourke to Jet? Reardon, oh. Hank Reardon,
oh.
The industrialist. I mean, you're involved in some pretty heavy industry.
Yes, and you know, I would try to kind of chart a simple, you know, course through this answer, but it's always just like life. It's kind of a bit more complex. I sort of fell into moving off of architectural services into manufacturing and invention of new technologies that are related to, let's say, environmentally responsible products, and then, of course, solar, which is renewable energy generation.
Bob, could you speak up a little bit? You're kind of like fading away.
Yeah, I can. I'll lean more into the phone. How's that?
Super. Thank you.
So what happened, as I mentioned before, was what kind of spawned this for me was when I was asked to develop a manufactured building system, to invent a system that would utilize panels that were made from wheat straw from the fields of Texas. And this was in the mid-80s. And I enjoyed it so much, and the company I was working for put millions of dollars into building these manufactured homes called the Pyramid system. And it got a lot of press attention, and then many people, including Pliny Fisk, who you may know, out of Texas, came to visit me. And I sort of got plugged into the passion of clean tech. But the problem for me was this, was that the technologies and the materials and all of the things that architects and builders and government agencies and the private sector were going to need did not exist. They just weren't available. Non-toxic products, panels, we had formaldehyde in our particle board and plywood and MDF and all of that. And so my course has been very much over the last many years around looking for solutions to those. And the problem is that the solutions means you must raise capital, build companies that manufacture, and then sell those products to markets that are not, they're sort of first early adopter type markets because it's all new. So that's what I decided to do early on, let's see, halfway through my career.
Cool. I want to interrupt your narrative just a moment to ask what role Pliny Fisk may have played. I know about him sort of as a free radical in the chemistry of the built environment, but I have not met him, and we've not been able to speak with him yet.
His participation. I haven't. Let's put it this way: I brought him on as an environmental consultant in the mid '80s, and he's extremely knowledgeable about indigenous sustainable infrastructure worldwide, and knew more about passive solar, active solar, and all kinds of environmental control systems. So that's why he came to visit, and then we kind of joined hands at that time.
Uh-huh.
We now just recently are joining hands on some projects right now, which is great because I haven't had enough contact with him over the years. But he was an early leader in sustainable infrastructure.
So I understand. Yes. Speaking from a New York City point of view, but then we get to the issue of capital. Where's the seed money come from?
Well, it's building any company that requires capital through some years towards profitability is very tough in any environment. And what I did in my career, going back and forth from industrialist to architectural services to a variety of things, was I was able to accumulate some capital and then always provide the seed funding for
you robbed a few banks.
Nope. Yeah, in a sense. Well, you know, businesses like that. And so the businesses that I've had, I have done all the seed funding myself, but at a certain point, I needed to raise outside capital, which I became somewhat of an expert in after the first several million. And
stop, please. No architect I know has a few million to put into an entrepreneurial project.
Well, I didn't tell you exactly how much I've spent, but in several ventures over several decades, invested a lot, but raised a lot more than that for the ventures from individual investors and private equity firms and strategic partners in particular, companies that have an interest.
So what you're telling me is that as you became investors, you have to understand that Heritage Radio Network is educational at its highest self. So I'm asking these questions because people want to know, how do you do this? So what I hear you say...
You get an MBA from Harvard, and that's how you do it, right?
It helps.
You started into business and you got involved in business ventures, and then you met other people who had deeper pockets, and you did other ventures, and some of that accrued to you, which enabled you to have more seed money yourself. Is that an adequate simplification or no?
Since I do a lot of, let's say, sort of mentoring or discussing with all kinds of entrepreneurs about how to go through the process of raising capital and getting their ideas out to market, it's sort of like this: you take the funds that you have, whatever savings you have or whatever assets you have, and you invest all of that in your venture to get it to a point where you will attract the next investor. And usually, they say, it's friends and family. That would be a next stage. And then after that, it would be a so-called angel investor or high net worth individual may come in when you need, half a million or $1 million or something. And then when you get real traction, you can then go out with stock offerings where you're always selling equity. You're selling the stock in your company. That's all, you know, that's the only thing anybody's interested in. And so there, you know, it's very complicated, but there are stages of development. And at a certain point, you may be able to attract institutional investors who are looking to put in maybe $5 or $10 million into your growing venture, but it has to be, you know, far enough along to interest them. So it's very complicated, and there are no specific rules, but you have to have something that is of a financial interest to a risk taker investor all the way along your course. So that's kind of the shortest I can put.
So how have you been doing? I'm just curious. How
I think you must be doing pretty well.
Well, we have been
for an architect.
My two companies now, the product companies,
well,
are
Envision Solar,
which is public. I took it public 2 years ago. It's a small company, around 10 people.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that next. Good.
Yeah, that's the stock symbol is EVSI. So it's a public company. The other is Noble Environmental Technologies, which is private, and that's the owner of E-Core, which is our environmental core material and our composite product. Well, and Morgan's sitting here right next to me.
We'll get to that in the next segment. And I'm very interested in that, but let's spin out on the solar thing right now.
Yes. Well, let me just for you and your audience, how that started in Envision Solar. I was, one of my ventures was to acquire half of Tucker Sadler Architects in San Diego. So I was practicing architecture as one of my ventures back from 2000 till 2005. And I was asked to design, if I'd be interested in designing a solar carport for Kyocera Corporation. Kyocera is one of the largest solar panel manufacturers. They have offices in San Diego. And they assumed that I would not be interested in doing such a small project, but we wanted the project. And to me, the notion of solar carport, in other words, structures that would elevate solar over parking lots and shade cars, was thrilling. And so I invented what's called the solar tree with just one column and with the branches. We call them the trunk and the branches and the canopy and all the biomimetic kind of translation. And it was exhilarating for everyone. And so we built the first solar grove, we call it, 25 solar trees in San Diego. And to me, on day one, just when I heard the concept, I knew that there was a commercial opportunity and there was an opportunity for me to build a company around that model.
Even though at that point electric vehicles were just... what year was this?
Well, it was early 2004, and Curtis, I'll tell you, at the time, when I and I've been criticized for maybe not telling the truth here, but here's the truth. I Googled solar carport in early 2004, immediately after I was approached by the management of Kyocera, and there was nothing. There was, it would show a carport and then a little solar panel on the roof. And I thought, my God, this doesn't make sense as a master plan. As a sustainable master planning architect, we've got to get solar over the parking lots.
Sure.
So, but the other part of it was immediately for me, because I'm a fan of clean vehicles. I drive a Volt now, which I drive it on electricity wherever possible. Knowing that plug-in hybrids are coming down the road, and knowing that charging electric vehicles is going to happen. Where would you guess? In parking lots, where cars are parked all day in the shade? Yes, and that was something that I was developing concepts for commercializing back in 2005. And then so, Envision, we launched Clean Charge, solar charging for electric vehicles as part of the column of the tree, the solar tree. And we also invented Envision Track, which is an integral tracking mechanism that allows the entire 34 by 34 foot canopy to actually track the sun during the day. So
that's really hot.
Cool.
That is
very
hot. Well, I
tell you, we've just completed, Envision Solar's just completed two projects here in San Diego, one with six solar trees for
the
utility here.
So.
And the other is for a major government installation here. And I got to tell you, it is exhilarating to be there at the Solar Grove in the presence of these monstrous structures that are actually moving all day long. It's kinetic sculpture, from my point of view, and as the, you know, the highest order. So it's really exhilarating. So we've incorporated everything, and fortunately, electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids have actually become a reality, so that it wasn't something we were just talking about.
I suppose that then the
that's
big
really cool. That's cool.
That is totally cool. But I'm supposing that the I'm calling it big iron, but I don't know what the real term is. Power generating collaboratives who burn coal to make electricity and pump it out through the grid would be very happy to hold your toes to the coals and say, well, okay, what's the cost effectiveness of this as compared with the life cycle of a coal-burning electrical plant? I mean, isn't there economy of scale in creating electricity in a coal-burning plant that you don't have in these little solar trees that rotate around and they make their own electricity? But how much?
It's actually a beautiful idea.
It's a great idea, but I'm just playing the devil's advocate.
Your question is the core question and issue we've been addressing since 2004. The short answer to your question is that we can't compete with the very low cost of electricity that's delivered to your house by a coal-burning plant.
And but that is normal. Also...
That's the short answer.
Yeah, but
the
that...
Long answer
yeah,
is
but
we
hold on, Bob, but that... Low cost to my house is
politics now.
No, that's subsidized. That's a subsidized cost, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. If you pare it all down in terms of a life cycle cost, and these solar trees will last for 20, 30, 50 years and still be passively functional and producing a tremendous amount of clean energy. The actual economics are very compelling on even a 5 or 8 years and certainly a 30-year horizon. It's more of an infrastructure decision by a society whether they want passive clean energy generation, and that's really what the solar over this what we call distributed generation solar is all about. And putting it, you know, all rooftops are great, carports and solar parks. Solar parking structures, absolutely
sure.
Great.
But are you saying
it's essential?
Are you saying if it it costs more, it's still not going to happen? Is that what you're saying, Curtis?
No, I'm only asking the question because I think that the question has to be answered to the legislators who decide how much the prevailing rate should be for conventionally provided electricity, and which then becomes a hidden subsidy to the big iron energy producers.
Right.
Okay.
Curtis, and that this is central to the entire discussion and adoption of solar. And I'll put my Southern California hat on here for a second. There's what's called the California Center for Sustainable Energy, about 100 people in a nonprofit. I've been the chair, I was the chair of that organization. I'm still on the board, and it manages the California Solar Initiative rebate program, and it educates the public about it, and it works with the utilities around all this. The dynamics are changing rapidly around solar.
Good.
San Diego area, Southern California, is the leading solar area in the world. San Diego's the leading solar city in the world now for a lot of reasons, not just because we have a lot of sun. It's because there's so much support for all of this. But here are the basic dynamics.
Well, it helps
General
that you have a lot of sun, Bob.
We do, and in fact, we have a lot of sun right now. And
yeah, you're not going to get that
outside
in
except for this, but solar distributed generation solar costs are dropping so precipitously that even General Electric came out with an announcement recently that they saw grid parity, which means that
grid parity.
Grid parity.
That
have
is
you ever
huge.
Heard that before?
No, that is
grid
huge.
Grid parity, it's called.
Oh man, that's I'm
grid parity. Remember that, it kind of rolls off your tongue. Grid parity is when the cost of generating electricity from solar is identical to producing it at a major power plant. And that's just a few years away in its most raw form, which is rooftop. So cost of solar is dropping.
I looked into Wonderful. It. I had to put a new roof on my little vacation house, and I looked into it, and it was almost worth it. It was like almost worth it at the time.
But you have to look at the life cycle cost.
Yeah, and I look at the initial capital investment.
Now, one thing that
if you don't have the do-re-mi and you don't have a loan source, you're dead.
Yeah. One thing that bothers me, Bob and Jake, is that solar cells are space technology, and we don't really have a 50-year track record with that space technology.
Right. Well, that's why when I...
Well, okay, John Glenn orbited, like, you know, 2 weeks ago, 50 years ago, you know, Jake, you were like 10 years old or something, you know. But
right.
But we don't know the life cycle of solar, of PVAs, right?
But actually, Curtis, we do. The beautiful thing about polycrystalline solar panels, photovoltaic panels, they were invented in the United States. Bell Labs still has solar panels that were put out 50 years ago that are still operating. So, and it's just silica. It's literally just
right, and it's all the stuff
sand.
Of the sand, right?
And the beauty of these panels is that they are very robust, and there's no reason to believe they won't be high functioning for, as I said, 3, 4, 5 decades or more.
You're saying that with the way they work and the mineral composition is just it just doesn't degrade.
And the other materials that are used, the aluminum, there are some composites that are used, et cetera. There's some metals, but these are very robust technologies.
Bob, I hate to go into the I'm going to bust your chops mode, but Bell Labs started.
It's his show, man. Go, Wayne.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Bell Labs started out at West Beth on West Avenue in New York City in Manhattan. Then it moved to Homedale, New Jersey.
All right.
Then the Bell Telephone Company was broken up by Nixon, I think. I don't know.
Who knows? No, it was broken up by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and so if there are still solar cells, in terms of being able to be a good editor of your content, Bob, I have to ask you, where are those cells now?
I don't know where they are. But okay. I know that they exist in a lab in a lab somewhere.
What is the expected life cycle
The product warranties are 25 years, and they're guaranteed for an output which has a reduction of a very small percentage over the full 25 years.
So 25 is good. 25 is good.
Yeah, the actual longevity.
And is that a real figure in terms of actual, you know, history, practice?
Well, these are the warranties that are provided by these enormous companies.
Yeah, no, I know, but...
Yeah.
So that'll tell you.
But is 20 years about the lifespan? So should we figure 20 years?
I'd figure much longer than that.
That's a good question because, Jake... Jake, that's a good question because about 30 years ago, my parents bought a rubber hose from Montgomery Ward, and it had a 25-year warranty, and it failed after about 20, but there was no Montgomery Ward anymore.
Right. Well.
Yes.
Yeah.
The financing, Curtis, just the financing is typically 20 years under a power purchase agreement. So we could just say, for purposes of this discussion, 20 years is the lifespan.
Okay.
So, Bob, after GST, Did you get an MBA from HBS?
I went back to the HBS for an OPM program, which is Owner President Management Program. It was 3 summers and received a certificate. Not a degree, but it's a certificate.
I'm just asking.
It was, by the way, it was worth doing. I recommend it to everyone.
I was thinking of doing something like that myself. I was just curious whether you were so deeply steeped in academia that, you know, it would be impossible to talk to you, but obviously it's not. Jack, could we have the next break, and then we're going to talk about E-Core.
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. How often at night, when the heavens are bright with the light of the glittering stars, I stood there amazed, and I asked as I gazed, does their glory exceed that of ours? Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play.
Burning Down the House with Pete Seeger, which gets us into talking with Robert Noble, Morgan Noble, Jake L. Spector about new technologies. And in our next segment, we want to talk about E-Core, one of the components that most intrigues all of us is, well, tell us about E-Core.
Curtis, I know what you were going to say. You were going to talk about
the bovine waste, no?
The cow manure.
That's why we played a cowboy song. All right. tell us about your wonderful new product that includes post-consumer and post-industrial waste and also post-agricultural waste.
Yes, well, I'll give you the short story. E-Core is, the company name is Noble Environmental Technologies, and sort of the flagship product is called E-Core, which is an environmental core material, so it's sort of like an aphorism for that, E-C-O-R. And what it is it's a panel product that can be fabricated flat or curved or shaped, and all kinds of things. It's all on our website, the ecoreglobal.com. But the panels are basically a composite of flat skin panels and then what we call a 3D EMF, which is three-dimensional engineered molded fiber core, which allows you to create a stressed skin panel or a sandwich panel in virtually any shape and any configuration. The beauty of the core technology is that we use 100% recycled cardboard, recycled paper, in some cases, as you mentioned, what Morgan...
I alluded to.
You alluded to, you were going to mention.
Bovine waste.
We call it bovine processed fiber.
It's hey, man, I thought this was the internet.
Cow shit. Okay.
Well, exactly. In fact, I did call it a bovine material originally. That was the name, but people were shortening it to BM, and it was kind of falling.
Right.
It was falling flat with some audiences, but it was getting a hoot from others. So it's the bovine process fiber is it's at a dairy farm. The cows eat corn silage, which is a very high fiber content.
Oh no!
Yes.
Not at Hearst Ranch, one of Heritage Radio Network's prime sponsors. They are only grass-fed and grass-finished.
Well, okay. I can tell you, grass works great too because it's cellulose fiber. But what happens with paper, just really quickly, what happens with paper? You get when you have a piece of paper, that's a wood fiber. It's made from a tree. And that tree had to, the chips from that tree had to be digested mechanically and chemically to extract the lignins and hemicellulose and other things. So you end up with pure cellulose fiber. The beauty of recycled fiber.
You're using a cow to do your wood chipping for you.
Well, the cow has four stomachs, so they're four natural digesters.
Chews it up.
And then all of it goes and is flushed into what's called an anaerobic digester. And many, many farms now have them where it's all with water, all the cow manure is pushed into it's an enormous chamber, typically underground or in tanks above ground. And water is extracted. Methane is then burned in a generator to generate clean electricity. And the methane's converted to carbon dioxide, which is 1/20th as damaging as greenhouse gas. And then, but one of the byproducts is the pure fiber, and it's very clean. By the way, it smells like a barnyard. It smells good. It reminds you of your childhood. And those fibers, when we use them in making our panels, which is a wet process.
Maybe not yours. I was talking to Jake. Jake grew up in Brooklyn.
It reminds me of mine, actually.
I grew up in Chicago, so
there was a little farm right near us.
Oh, well, that's nice.
There you go. So it'll remind you of your childhood. You'll have fond memories, or you might remember your brother beating you up. I don't remember.
I would remember both, actually. But always fondly.
But the amazing thing is that the panels that we made using agricultural fibers are so strong. And it is an almost valueless raw material, and we use it to produce panels that we can get. We can get the product for $0 per ton, and we're selling panels at the equivalent.
So I have a question for you, because one of my favorite products is using wood fibers that are of small willow. You've heard of Tectum, right? Love using Tectum.
Yeah.
And have you ever tried mixing yours with gypsum to make it more fireproof? Because I was looking at your website, and I guess
that's one
of the problems.
We're engaged in our fire retardant research right now, which includes a variety of different things. So the answer is yes.
Yeah, gypsum, I think to make it into a slurry the way they do, and then there's sort of somehow you then have to aerate it, right? Some process to get it.
There are a lot of different components, of the pulping process. So, just to finish up on what E-Core is that so it's 100% recycled, and I think we can call bovine process fiber recycled. It is when we produce it, we use no additives. There's no petroleum products, not even any natural oils. We use no additives, so it is 100% non-toxic. It's as close to zero as you can possibly get, and that's what our independent testing has shown. It's 100% bio-based.
So you're saying that E-Core has no glues?
It's like that piece of paper that's sitting in front of you. It uses the same adhesive, which is nothing. There is no adhesive in E-Core. That's the core panel. When we put them all together, we do use glues, and the glue typically is what's called PVA, which is Elmer's.
Okay.
It's non-toxic. Elmer's, you may know, is non-toxic. You can put your hands in it all day long.
Yeah. But doesn't Elmer's have some polyvinyls in it that come from oil?
Well, if it's pure PVA, it's non-toxic, and it may have that in it. I don't know the actual.
You're saying is vinyl doesn't react with anything anyway. It's sort of.
Yeah, but vinyl presently comes
sort of indestructible. I've heard that vinyl people can recycle it.
I'm putting on my anti-oil hat right now.
All right. Okay. All right. Go for it.
If it's got oil-based product, I worry about. Bob, you're being able to make this, 20 years in the future when we run out of oil.
Curtis, your whole direction here, Morgan and I are kind of looking at each other, smiling and nodding. You're absolutely right. This is exactly the type of rigor that we put everything we're doing through. And we look at everything, and this is going to be added to our list of digging even deeper into. We attempt to use nothing if possible. The best way to avoid toxins is to use nothing.
Yeah, yeah. And well, toxins, Bob, toxins are one aspect in terms of sustainability and industrial futurism, yeah. Or, you know, a future, is I myself would like to promote technologies that do not rely on oil that came from crushing shale in Canada, but rather Elmer's glue used to come from cows.
Borden, with the
right.
cow.
But then,
we're back to cows again.
Yeah, but then it, but then, but then, the, but then the, but then Elmer's glue changed. You know, the library paste that Jake, that you and I grew up with in Bob.
Well, that was different. Library paste was different than Elmer's, though. But you're right. Elmer's
you get my point, Bob.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the sort of the pleasures of the business that we have is that we, this is why
he'll
cheap paper.
He'll have to invent the glue next.
What we're needing to do is either invent it or we ferret out
really?
The most advanced development in those areas. But the fundamental principle is what we call, what Kelly Johnson, who was the head of Skunk Works for Lockheed Martin, used to say, we add lightness. We add lightness. And that means that we eliminate anything that is not essential to the specifications of what we're producing. And so we've gotten rid of virtually everything. It's just fiber and water and clean water, and we recycle. We recycle. It's closed loop in our factory. We recycle all of the water. And in fact, we're looking at rainwater capture so that we can end up having 100% rainwater. It's just in principle, it's very important to us.
Does it rain that much in San Diego? I really don't
very
know.
Very little.
Yeah?
Very little, although we don't need much water. So that's it can work out. So but for what ECOR is, just to finish it up, is as an architect, this is driven by not just its environmental characteristics. It's for us, it was driven by providing for the future, a very low-cost and very cost-effective way, a compelling way for architects to do what they want to do. They want to make shapes. Everybody wants to do what Frank Gehry's doing, and they want to do it everywhere. In other words, in principle, can you make the shapes that you want? Can you have the textures and the colors? Mm-hmm. And is it going to get value engineered out later by the owner and the contractor because that those shapes on the walls and the ceiling and the reception desk and everything that you have is too expensive? ECOR allows the end product to be much less expensive to build because it is eliminating all of the conventional weight. It's a liberator for architects. And really, if I was talking about
double
anything
curve.
That it was at the core of ECOR, it is that it is an enabler for designers to freely realize their vision.
Bob, can you hang with us for another 10 or 12 minutes? Because I'd like to take a little break and ask you about what you're looking at in the future and where you think that things are going. Is
Absolutely.
That all right? All right.
Love to.
Thanks. Cool. Jack?
I'm a traveler of all time and space.
Burning in the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here with Bob Morgan. Oh, God, what am I thinking about? Bob Noble, Jake Allspector. Bob, Jake has a question for you.
Can you double curve it? I was looking for that.
Talking about E-Core.
Yeah, the sandwich.
Yeah. Double curve it, meaning like a compound curve or one?
Like, you know, a spherical shape or you know.
Or a dome.
Not a two-dimensional warp surface. You know, it's a
compound curve. We have not made interior cores that are compounded as in a spherical shape.
Yeah.
The
base sheet can be done. It's the intercore that's the technical problem,
sheet,
right?
I don't think the base sheet has as much elasticity as that. It would probably tear, wouldn't it?
Well, you've got forms, Bob, right? I mean, you've got...
It'd probably just fray apart, you know. I kind of have a... After reading how you did and to cut it and all that, I was getting a sense of what it was from that and the photograph, so... Yeah, I think.
Well, there are ways of accomplishing almost anything, and if you look at the photographs, you'll see just a few types of curves we've done. We can do compound curves and segmented curves, and in a variety of different ways, and we've done them. Right. But for doing curved surfaces, we can do what we call honey core, which is the honeycomb core version. But the biggest issue is the skin itself. And that has to be
skin.
That has to be
skin.
Elastic. So
yeah.
there are ways of doing it, but we have
that's
not made
a
dome
about the skin.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, Jake's getting into his dome period.
No. I was just worried about all the shapes that people make that you describe. They're all they're usually made out of metal that's been kind of stretched a little bit. And, you know.
Yes.
So looking forward, Bob.
Looking forward.
Yeah. From PVAs that shade cars to panelized product that uses waste material, what's next? I mean,
well,
where do we go?
You mean for me or for us, in my view?
Take your pick. How about you?
Well, starting with me... these are both of these companies, Envision Solar and Noble Environmental, in a sense are, I would say, sort of end games for me in terms of companies. Their opportunities are unlimited. The growth potential is unlimited, and they've already captured the sort of the archetype. Did I lose you?
No, we're here.
Okay, yeah, something happened. They've already captured what I'd say archetypal designs for those different industries. The solar tree is a complete product and technology. So our focus is now, and has been, is the growth of that and selling them to all the car dealers and all the public agencies and all the military bases and all that. And that's what we're doing. And we call it solar forestation. So that's what's next for me and the company, and Desmond Wheatley, who's the CEO now, and everybody else.
Solar forestation.
So they're solar trees, so when we plant them everywhere, it's called solar forestation, as in foresting.
Yeah,
it's another one of our metaphors. So that's what's in it for me, is that focus to realize the vision that I had so many years ago. And that's a daily thing. Lots of time during my week is focused on that. On E-Core, it's really getting the seed of this new technology out there and proven and profitable. As a company, we raise money to build a factory, and we must move towards profitability, or at least be seen as trending toward it, so we can get the capital to grow and to get the product out there.
Sure.
And then part of it, a big part of it, is just even this, you know, talking with design professionals and people in industry and saying, yeah, we can do that, we can't do that, we can do that, and solving problems to get this new kind of extremely disruptive material technology out into the market, into designers' hands, to see it everywhere, which we're doing. So that's, on the personal level, that's what I'm focused on. And but on a broader sense, it's, I got to take a kind of a positive look at things because that's just the way I see it. It's amazing how explosive now the interest in environmental materials and energy efficiency and energy responsibility is now compared to what it was when I started in this 30 years ago. It's just, I'm glad it's happening in my lifetime rather than happening after. So
for sure.
I think that the trends are going to continue. The public's more knowledgeable. As you know, you're probably both involved with LEED. 10 years ago, when I was speaking with audiences, no one knew what LEED was. Now everybody knows what it is, and they usually are accredited professionals. So it's just constantly pushing on this forward-moving trend, and people like both of you who are sort of leading the discussion about this is really what's going to continue to have such a positive effect and get it out there and get it accepted, no longer new and disruptive, but have it be part of the fabric of our culture.
Bob, I'd like to circle back to one thing and insert one other thing, if possible. I don't see this as a disruptive material. We've known about honeycombed.
It's a green honeycomb.
Yeah, it's a green honeycomb. We've known about hollowcore doors since the early 60s, which is not to denigrate what you've done.
Right.
What you've done.
And IKEA uses panelization similarly.
Yes.
But not as green.
I myself would love to be able to take your product and use it in architecture, for good reason, requires flame spread resistance, and you're not there yet. If we use wood, it has to have smoke
retardant.
Or a smoke development ratio equal to oak.
Depending on where you use it. It really depends.
Well, New York
you can't use any of it in a fire stair, for instance.
No, but in ordinary spaces in New York City, it's got to be equivalent to oak.
Yeah.
White oak with a flame spread.
Is that right?
Yeah, with a flame spread.
It's on the ceiling.
Equivalent
of
100.
Right, right.
And therefore, it needs to be somehow. There needs to be some ingredient. It might be calcium carbonate. It might be
gypsum.
Gypsum that
some inorganic.
Exactly, that permits us to be able to specify your product.
How about silica that absorbs light and re-energizes it somehow?
That would make.
I love that. By the way, I love this conversation. Our out of all of the items on our to-do list for R&D and all of our kind of progressive funding of those of high-strength material and water repellency and water resiliency and moisture resistance and dimensional stability and a lot of things, the fire retardants and fireproof characteristics are where we're focusing our R&D work right now. For the
good,
we are doing exactly what you're saying because it's so essential. To have these products available for commercial applications, and we want safe materials.
Yeah, so commercial, residential, institutional, everything. Yeah, everything beyond a 3-unit house has got to be subject to pretty much the International Building Code.
I think maybe you'd probably be looking into is things that use your mixture, and you probably create some kind of a slurry, don't you? Right?
Yes, it's a wet process slurry. So, Jake, you're right. One of the major opportunities that we're exploring now is a very, let's say, non-toxic mineral additives that are easily available and are relatively inexpensive that provide performance. But it goes into the slurry. Right. The others are, it's what we call post-production, where we treat the panels.
Well, once you do have it in a slurry, you could do things like deposit it like a 3D printer, and you could make shapes out of it. you know, that are totally, and I'm not a computer CAD CAM person, but you need a fairly robust machine that could deposit that quickly and in shapes and with a honeycomb structure of its own.
Jack,
as the both of you learn more about what we're doing, you're going to be thrilled.
That's the future, I think.
Let us agree that we should reconvene sometime in the future and talk about 3D printing of E-Core materials. This has been Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne with Richard Noble, Morgan Noble, Jake Allspector. Keep the faith. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Curtis.
Thank you, Curtis.
Talk with you again.
Nice to talk to you, Bob.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.